had incredible bipartisan support because we flexed our muscles and set those demands and made them have to agree with us, even to cut their own pay and to ban stock buybacks. They have money and control. We have the power. We exercise the power. We take control. We take the money.
That's Sarah Nelson, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Sarah Nelson on union power. There's power in a union. Is not just an empty slogan or the title of a song. It's a shared reality for many working people. When labor organizes itself into a union, it can exert power over bosses. It can demand higher wages and better working conditions and benefits. The CEO class offer workers crumbs while pocketing the big bucks in salaries, bonuses, and stock options for themselves. The propaganda system is largely under the control of ruling elites and big business. Thus, unions are painted negatively. However, a Gallup poll shows that union support among workers has increased significantly in recent years. From Amazon to Starbucks to Kaiser to postal workers in Canada, there has been an upsurge in workers going on strike and unionization. Solidarity makes a difference. Our guest today is Sarah Nelson. She's the president of the Association of Flight Attendants Union. She has long been an advocate for workers' rights and unions. InStyle magazine named her as one of its 50 badass women. She spoke at the University of Oregon in Eugene in mid-November 2024. And now, Sarah Nelson, Union Power.
So I do typically start off as an organizer talking about how I got involved. You know, I grew up here in Oregon, and I also grew up in a home with a religion that was started by a woman, Mary Baker Eddy. And I really think it's just important that I share some of this, because when I was growing up, I didn't really have any sense that because I was a girl, I had any less opportunity to contribute to this world as a little boy. Because Mrs. Eddy taught us that male and female qualities are both necessary to express the full expression of God, and that you really can't celebrate one type of quality without understanding that they all go together to form the whole being. Mrs. Eddy also taught us that error is what you see when something is out of sorts, and you shouldn't give this thing attention. You need to cast it aside and focus on what's real. And so I'll come back to that in a little bit. But as I was growing up and in fourth grade in Mr. Parker's classroom, he asked all the little fourth grade students, what do you want to be when you grow up? And of course, a lot of kids had different answers. I want to be a fireman, or I want to be a teacher, or I want to be a doctor or a lawyer. And I didn't know what to say, so I said, President of the United States. And Mr. Parker said, oh, you want to be the first female president of the United States? And I thought, well, I don't really want to do too hard things, no. I guess I'll be like my mom and be a teacher. But it hadn't dawned on me until much later what that comment really meant. Here I was, a fourth grader, and there was still no comprehension that anytime soon there would be a woman who could possibly be president of the United States. So went off to college and in Southern Illinois, and learned to be a secondary teacher, graduated with my English degree and finished up my student teaching in the fall. And as I was graduating, my best friend, Chloe, had decided as a physics major that she hated physics. And so on one of our last breaks, she was house sitting for a family of United Airlines employees. And they said to her, you should really go apply and be a flight attendant. United is hiring. And we thought this was the most hilarious thing. She went through the process and had been hired and was going to become a flight attendant. And we laughed about it. Well, about 9 months later, in February, in a very snowy day in St. Louis, when my two younger brothers had big things going on at school, one had a big concert, another one had a big race as a runner, and I wanted to get to that, but I was broke and looking at that student loan debt and working four jobs at the time, trying to make ends meet, wondering how I was going to set up my classroom the next year as a first teacher because there was no money from the school district to invest in the inner city schools in St. Louis. And so my friend Chloe called me and she said, guess where I am? I'm at Miami Beach in my bikini with my toes in the sand right now, and you're in snowy St. Louis. And so she gave me a hard time about that for a while, and then she said, no, seriously though, I know we laughed about this, but let me just tell you about this job. It's no joke. And she told me about the pay that was going to be higher than my first year teacher pay. She told me about the flexibility on the job. She told me about the health care that had been negotiated by women, so it actually covered what women need in health care. And she also told me about the pension. And at 23, working four jobs, hearing that I could take pension as early as age 50 sounded like a really good thing, and it's actually that pension that made me get into my car and drive to Chicago the next day, interview with United Airlines. And what I didn't know at the time, and she didn't put it in these terms, but she was describing the flight attendant contract that had been bargained ever since 1946. And that very first flight attendant contract, after organizing in 1945, had four major pillars in it. It had a double-digit pay increase. It had a cap on the number of hours that you could work. It had a seniority list so that managers could no longer try to coerce flight attendants to trade sex for schedules. And it, which was the foundation of beating back all the other discriminatory practices over the years. And it also had an eight-hour day. And that eight-hour day was the product of 80 years of a labor movement fighting for that standard. Fighting, think about this, fighting without any labor laws that would hold companies accountable or give any kind of process for those workers. They had to rise up together and fight through everything, through incredible violence, in order to form these foundations and fight so much that the bosses finally wanted to agree on labor law so there would be some kind of stability for them in order. And so here I was driving to Chicago based on all of these fights from the past, and I became a flight attendant, and United Airlines sent me off to Boston after 7 weeks of unpaid training. And here we are getting an apartment in Boston, a very expensive city to live in, seven of us from our training class, and trying to go off on my flying career, waiting for that first paycheck to drop. And my roommates got their first paycheck, and so I called up to see what was in there, and it was $12 that was left from the credit union loan that I had taken out even to get a place to stay in the first place. And so I went to the airport and went to the office with my train pass, my subway pass that I had because of my union contract, and asked a supervisor if they could help me. Why didn't I get my first paycheck? And they said, oh, you get your first paychecks at different times for different reasons. We're sure you get it next time. And I'm thinking, if they didn't tell me that I need to watch myself on probation, I might be having a different reaction right now. But I'm going to try to keep it together and figure out how to make this work. And got really cozy with Top Ramen. begged for assignments from the airline so that I could eat some plain food. Maybe got a couple dates. Those were steak and lobster nights. But got to the next payday. And as I was coming off of my trip before the next payday, this is real working class solidarity. In Boston, the hotel van drivers would drive the local crews to the hotel, and then they would drive the local flight attendants to our homes. And the custom was that we would give them a dollar as they were taking the bags off the van. And all I had left was a quarter. And I was his last stop, and I gave him the quarter, and I said, "I'm so sorry, that's all I have left." And he looked at me like, "Yeah, right, sister." I think he was thinking of a different word. And I was mortified. Went into the house, there's nothing, no one else is home, and there was nothing in the cupboards to eat. So I put on my uniform the next morning and hopped on a flight at 6 a.m. so that I could eat some more plain food while I was waiting for that paycheck to drop. And when I came back, I checked my account again, and now there's nothing in it. And rent is due the next day. This isn't just about me anymore. My roommates were counting on me too. And so I went down into the office, and I said, "Someone's got to help me." And I started to get some of the same answer. And it was the first time that I really understood what it meant to be just a number in an HR file. Not a person that people care about. And now I really am getting a little more excited than someone on probation should. And the tears are starting to roll. And all of a sudden, I had this tap on the shoulder. And I turned around, and there was someone standing there who I'd never seen before. But she looked a lot like me. She was wearing the same uniform, and I remember her union pin shining right above her wings. And she was holding her paycheck, and she asked me how to spell my name. And she handed me a check for $800, and she said, "Number one, you go take care of yourself. And number two, call our union." And I did call our union, and I had my paycheck the next day, but I always tell everyone that I learned everything I needed to know in that moment when my flying partner was standing in front of me. Because in our unions, we're never alone, and through our unions, we can be organized and get the most out of caring for each other. And so because I had called the union office, they called me and said, "Hey, would you like to help?" And I didn't know that people said no. And I was also so honored that they were asking me to help. And so I said, "Yes, I'll do the new hire presentations because this shouldn't happen to anyone else." And got very involved. And it was, and after probation, I did my probation exit interview and then went out on the picket line and led cheers for a new contract. And I got the name Sarah DeMouth in Boston. And then we negotiated a contract that I thought stunk. And I worked really hard to get it voted down. And I was a good organizer, and in Boston it went down by 80%. But across the system, it just barely passed. And I went to the union meeting afterwards, and people are throwing down their union pins. And I remember thinking, that looks really good. And then the flight attendant who had written me that check flashed in front of my eyes. And I thought about all the people that I had met in the workplace. These incredible people, creative, smart, intelligent people who had solved major problems, who had made sure that when we weren't even serving soup on the plane, if somebody wanted it, we somehow made it. They were doctors and lawyers and nurses and mothers and fathers, and I thought we can do better. And so I got even more engaged as a dissident in my union. And I got to have a real voice because the union was there. I got to speak up. I got to practice what I had learned growing up, that if you have a strong sense of justice and a loud mouth, you just might get your way. The other leaders in the union kept giving me additional jobs because I was really kind of a pain in the butt. And by the time I had been serving for 5 years, I was now serving as national strike chair. And then September 11th happened. And on that day, everything changed, and it changed very personally because United Airlines Flight 175, and you can picture this, it's the flight that flew into the South Tower of the World Trade Center. You can see it from all the camera angles because all cameras were trained on that site because 17 minutes earlier, American Flight 11 had flown into the North Tower. And for me, when I see that, I see Amy and Michael, and another Amy, Catherine, Al, Robert, Alicia, Marianne, and Jesus. And I say their names almost every day because they were extraordinary people. Any one of us in this room would have wanted to be like them. And as we were grieving the loss of our friends in Boston, and dealing with the furloughs that came right after that. And there's a sign up on the union door that says, never forget. And I'm thinking, who the hell is ever going to forget this? What I didn't know was that there were crisis capitalists planning right then to redefine the value of a flight attendant, a pilot, a gate agent, a ramp service person, to outsource the sky caps, to outsource the kitchens for the lowest possible standards. So I learned later what Mother Jones, the great labor organizer, told us over 100 years ago when she was traveling the country fighting against child labor. We need some Mother Jones spirit back right now. She said, the capitalists say there is no need of labor organizing, except the fact that they themselves are continually organizing shows us their real beliefs. The capitalists want the most amount of labor for the least amount of money, including slavery. Labor wants the most amount of money for the least amount of labor. When I used to say this quote, people used to kind of shrink away. We need to get proud of that. Every innovation should go in our pockets, not just in the pockets of Wall Street speculators. She said, labor built the world's palaces and created all the wealth, but neither spends the wealth nor dwells in those palaces. If you would only understand that you hold the whole solution in the palm of your hand. If, for example, every worker would simply hold up and stop working, the capitalists would yield to any and all demands because the world could simply not go on. And so this is a lesson in power. And this is also a lesson in worth. And it's also a lesson in which side we're on. Racism, sexism, xenophobia, any kind of bias or feeling of competition against another person is the construct of the boss, the construct of the capitalist to keep workers from coming together and forming our unions and fighting back for our fair share. I think about the mine workers in Ludlow, Colorado in the early 1900s, fighting in their tent city for fairness, in some cases, just to enforce the laws of Colorado that were in place. And there were 28 different languages spoken in that tent city. And the reason was that the bosses understood, the coal barons understood, that if they could hire people from different countries with different backgrounds, speaking different languages, it would be that much harder for them to talk with each other about forming a union. But here's the thing. The bosses don't understand. When mothers are comforting their children next to other mothers who are comforting their children in different languages, they don't have to understand the words. They understand the heartache of having lost their fathers and husbands, and oftentimes brothers who had gone into the mines too. And the fact that the boss was concerned about the donkeys more than the people who were lost in the mines. We have a common experience, and when we start in the workplace and find our common issues, even though it's the boss who decides who comes to that workplace, it's the last non-self-selecting place in America. We get to push through this idea that we are divided. We get to push through all of the efforts to make us fearful of each other and fearful that someone else's benefits are going to mean that we hurt. I call it the four D's of union busting: divide, delay, distract, and demoralize. And we have to identify those four D's so that we can assign it the title of error and set it aside and look for what's real. And what's real is our common need to take care of ourselves and our families, our children, and to hope for a better world, to demand what FDR set in motion should really give credit to Frances Perkins. Let's be real. It was the woman. But to have certain standards in society, to make a social compact that if you go to work and spend your time and contribute in that way, that you can expect in return a living wage and a safe home and an education for your children and the ability to get care if you're sick. You know, my mother just shared a story with me recently. I always thought that my family had been a bunch of really hardcore Republicans, and I was not wrong about that, except that she shared this story with me about my grandfather, who had come out to Oregon, really with that pioneer spirit, in the middle of the Depression, with his wife that he stole away from high society in Minnesota, to make his way in Bend, Oregon. And they hated FDR. They hated the idea of these social programs because they had worked so hard to build up wealth for their family. And they thought, you're going to tax me to give it to other people? Screw you. And then my grandfather became disabled, and he could no longer work. And because Social Security had been put in place, my mom and her entire family got to stay in their home, got to have the chance to go to college and live a good life. And my grandmother took my mom out in the car years later and said, I have to tell you, Carol, I was wrong. I was wrong about FDR. I was wrong. Our family owes everything we have to him. What FDR also said was that we should have an economic bill of rights, a right to a job with a living wage, right to a home, to an education, to a secure retirement, to security if we become sick or disabled. And these were the tenets of the party that was the party for the working class. And if people are asking right now, how did we get so far away from that? It's because of a lot of things. But there is a specific point beyond the passing of Taft-Hartley, which was the start of chipping away at unions and chipping away at working people's power, supercharged by President Reagan when he fired the air traffic controllers in 1981 and told corporations everywhere that it was open season on unions, that strike was a dirty word, that it was that unions were outdated, that unions were greedy. Those air traffic controllers who were out on strike, and many of them were sent to jail, they were fighting not only for an incredible pay raise, they were fighting for a 32-hour work week in 1981. And since that time, since unions have gone on decline down to just 6% of the private sector, productivity of the American worker has gone through the roof, higher than anywhere else in the world. All wages have remained flat. All of that productivity has gone into the pockets of Wall Street. And so I experienced all of this up close and personal after 9/11 when we went through a 38-month-long bankruptcy. And that 8-hour day that had been negotiated in 1946 was taken away. There were double-digit pay cuts. There was the termination of our pensions when $80 million would have saved them. The judge approved termination of the pensions, and in the next hammer of the gavel, approved $400 million in bonuses for the top executives. But because we fought, because our union fought every single day of that bankruptcy, I learned a lot. I learned that when you have people together who are willing to fight, who live in the words of Mother Jones, that says you will fight and lose, fight and win, but you must fight, that there is strength in the fight.
We saved retiree health care, and we doubled the amount that United Airlines was willing to spend in a pension replacement plan for the flight attendants because we fought. And we kept the power of our union. People were looking inward in that crisis, not able to look out, afraid of what was going to happen. Luckily, there was not social media at the time because they were sending us messages saying, give it all to the company. And we kept that from management, kept management from seeing that so that we could fight. But as we were fighting for our pensions, flight attendants were saying to us, but they're doing uniform compliance checks, and they don't want us to wear comfortable shoes. And this is a big deal because that 8-hour day was gone. People were working longer days. They were on their feet more than they ever had been. They had to work more. They agreed to lift that cap that we negotiated in 1946 because they needed to work as many hours as possible to keep their homes and their cars, and to try to keep the promise to their children that they could go to soccer camp or have piano lessons. And so as we're trying to talk about the importance of coming together to fight for our pensions, they're saying, but they're making us wear uncomfortable shoes. And I just want you to know that I am wearing my sneakers tonight because when I started, I did have to wear 2-inch heels as a United Airlines flight attendant. And so what I wanted to say to flight attendants was, my God, put on the comfortable shoes, tell them F you, they're holding the planes together with duct tape, for God's sakes. Get out on the pension line for our pensions. Get on the picket line for our pensions. And I didn't say that. We put together a petition. We ran a campaign to fight for the ability to wear comfortable shoes, and we won in a month's time. And so what that did, though, was that gave people a sense of agency. It gave them just a little taste of their collective power. It gave them the notion that when we come together and define our common interests, we can fight together with those clear demands. And so we took that to a strike vote to try to save our pensions, and turned out a 99% strike vote, and every single person was engaged. And so on the other side of this, we took this fight forward. And what I really learned, a lot of people say, you know, be careful. Use your power only when you really need to use it. Use your access to people when you only really need to use it. What I've learned is that using power actually builds power. Power expands, it doesn't contract.
Listening to Sarah Nelson on Union Power. This is Independent Alternative Radio. To get copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977 or online, our website, alternativeradio.org.
The next fight that we took on was the knife fight. When TSA said that they were going to allow knives back on the planes, really brilliant idea. But this had been in briefings for members all over Capitol Hill that TSA had made this argument that, no, we really have to focus on looking for bombs. We can't focus on looking for knives. And so they had planned to change national security policy. What we learned later is always follow the money. There was a knife lobby who had met with the TSA administrator the month before they announced this, and they were planning on selling $1 billion worth of knives that were TSA approved and had a USB port on the other end. So we were up against it. And we launched immediately. After this policy was announced, we launched 38 months later saying, hell no, this is not going to happen. And it actually was quite popular. We would take the fight to different congressional districts all over the country, and the Philadelphia Inquirer said, the knife fight is coming to Philadelphia. And so we backed the administrator off of implementing the policy. And then guess what? All the air went out of the balloon, and no one was paying attention anymore. And I knew that we had to do something about that. We had to inject urgency, Because in order to solve a problem, you have to define it, you have to set your demands, you have to back it up with what you're willing to do, and you have to add urgency. And so I might have talked to a few congressional offices all over the Hill and said, we're hearing that the TSA administrator is going to implement this on the Friday before Memorial Day. And all of a sudden, you know, we also might have talked to the Washington Post and said, we're hearing. And when they called the offices, they said, we're hearing that too. And pretty soon it was in the Washington Post. And then it was spread around the Hill that this was going to be implemented on Memorial Day. And I was up on the Hill that week talking to one of the Senate offices and explaining what a bad policy this was going to be. And explaining how I had been trained by FBI, tactical security people, about how this could create another catastrophe. And so while I gave this very reasoned argument, one of the Senate staffers reached over and rubbed my arm and said, oh, we know this is really emotional for you. And I was thinking in my head, well, they took my knife when I came into your workplace, mister. But I didn't say, I cleaned that up too. There might have been expletive in that. But then I went back to the CWA building because I was so distraught. By this time I had discovered that sexism actually does exist. And I went back to the CWA building and I said to the CWA president at the time, I said, Larry, we're just fighting to try to keep our workplace safe. But now I have to fight sexism too in this fight in order to win. And he said, Sarah, your friends died, right? Go back up there and tell them that you're not. I'm cleaning this whole thing up for you, by the way. There was lots of other very colorful words. Go back up there and tell them you're not leaving until this policy gets rescinded. And that's what we did. And with the urgency of that moment that it was going to be implemented and our continued demand for what was right, we won the next day. So we take all of this experience, and we also take the experience of my union understanding that after Carl Icahn fired all the TWA strikers in the late 1980s for striking and replaced them with replacement workers, and it took the flight attendants up to 5 years to get their jobs back, and the union was broken, that we had to have a different way of striking because everyone understood what it would mean if the pilots went on strike. But there was very little recognition of what it would mean if the flight attendants went on strike. And so we got creative and we looked into the Railway Labor Act and it allowed for intermittent strikes. And so in 1993, we developed CHAOS, Create Havoc Around Our System, which was our trademarked version of what was legal under the Railway Labor Act. And the Alaska Airlines flight attendants were in a contract fight at the time. And they had abysmal rules. They had a terrible management. And we had a real fight on our hands. They were already training replacement workers in order to do the same thing that Icahn had done. And so when we got to the strike deadline, we announced that we were going to use CHAOS. And we explained to the public, you won't know when or where we're going to strike. We will strike without warning. And this was a tactic so that they couldn't replace us. But what we learned through the process was that we also took the imagination of the press and the public. And before we even struck a flight, 20% of the bookings dropped. And management sent their managers out onto all the flights. They trained all of them, emptied out company headquarters, and had them flying around because we also said that we were going to strike in the middle of a flight. Which we never would have done, but they didn't know that, so they had people out there. And what happened after a few weeks was the managers came back and said, you know, you should really agree to the flight attendants' demands. It's actually really hard out there. So as they pulled them back in, we struck the first flight. And they didn't know what to do. We struck for 20 minutes, one flight. Think about a rainy day in the Pacific Northwest, right? But what they couldn't stand was that they no longer had control. We had taken control of the workplace. We had taken control of the schedule. And so they started to suspend workers and hold them out without pay. And we went to court and we won. And the strikers were reinstated with back pay. But what really happened then was that management said, we want to settle this contract with you tonight. And we said, don't you want to meet? And they said, no, we're going to offer you the entire Southwest Airlines contract. We want to do it by fax machine. We don't want to meet. Every time we meet with you, something bad happens. And so we did sign the contract that night. And a week later, they called back and said, we didn't know this one provision that hardly ever happens at Southwest happens all the time at Alaska, and this means flight attendants are going to get a 60% raise. You can't possibly hold us to this. And we said, yes, we can. And we did. So when I saw 2017 through 2020 and the White House and what was coming out of there, it was very familiar to me. I know chaos. I've created it. And so when we saw the government shutdown in 2018 into 2019, and there was the racist fear-mongering over the southern border wall, we recognized that was one of the Union Busters' 4Ds. That was a distraction. It was also a divide tactic. And it was a delay from getting solutions. And it was demoralization for the workers who were held out of work, for everyone all across the hill who couldn't even do their jobs for the country. And we recognized that, no, it's not about the southern border wall. This is about accruing more power to the executive, because if there were an accident or a terrorist attack, everyone would have looked to the executive to solve it right away, and they would have said, we don't need the bureaucracy of our government, we're going to privatize everything. And if nothing had happened during all that time, they would have said the same thing, because they would have said, see, we're right. We don't need to pay for all of these things. We should privatize everything. It'll be much better service for the American people. And we also looked at this, and we realized this was a moment where air traffic controllers were required to come to work without pay. And we were seeing op-eds all over the country that said that if the air traffic controllers would just strike, this would be over. You don't say that to people who are locked out. You rush to their side, and you stand with them, and you show the boss that we're together, and we're going to stand up for the people who are being mistreated. And so... So we said, we're going to strike because it is not safe. And we're calling on the rest of the labor movement to strike with us and use a general strike in this moment when a million people are out of work or forced to come to work without pay. And another million contractors are out of work with no hope of any retroactive pay and just with no warning. I remember traveling across D.C. during the time, and I was talking in the car to different media outlets and talking about what we were working on. And when I got let out at my office and I went to pay the cab driver, I went to hand him a bill to pay the cab fare. And he turned around and he grabbed my hand, and he had a tear coming down his cheek. And he said, thank you, you're fighting for me too. Because there were no cab fares, because the government was shut down. We have so much more in common than anything that could ever divide us. And when we defined our power in that moment, when we said that we were going to take control, and then those 10 air traffic controllers in Jacksonville Center said that they could no longer safely do their jobs because they were exhausted with the stress and distraction of not getting a paycheck and not knowing how to take care of their families. And a few flights started to cancel in LaGuardia. And we said, Mitch McConnell, can you hear us now? The government shutdown was open in a matter of hours, when just that morning it looked like there was no end in sight. And the reason that it was over was because workers were taking control, and the GOP understood that if workers got a taste of our power, we would upend the entire system, and the jig would be up on the 4Ds of union busting, and we would be united in demanding all of the things that are popular in this culture. Taking on climate change with good green jobs, good union jobs, making sure that everyone has access to health care, making sure that people can have a secure retirement and a safe home to live in,
opening our arms to people who are destitute and just looking for a better life when they're coming to our border and hoping to contribute in our society. They knew it was all going to be upended. And so they ended that government shutdown, not because they got their border wall, not because of anything other than the idea that working people were going to understand the power that we have. So in this moment, when things seem dire, it's really important that we remember that that power still exists every moment together. And when the Me Too movement broke, I turned around to our communications people and I said, get ready, phone's going to ring. I said, what do you mean? I said, well, they're going to talk about people who are sexually harassed or assaulted on the jobs, and it's only going to take them about a millisecond before they decide to call the flight attendant union. And sure enough, they started to call. And the Washington Post asked me to write an op-ed to say, what is the one thing that CEOs could do to help this issue right now? And I said, the airline industry needs to denounce its sexist past. It needs to say there's a zero tolerance policy for this kind of action in the workplace or in travel space. And it needs to lift up flight attendants as safety professionals. And so they did that. But the other thing that we did was we put out a survey to our members because I knew what my experience had been on the job. I remembered the first year on the job when I was standing there setting up the galley and some guy comes up behind me and touches my rear end and says, what, no girdle? How do you look this good in your uniform without a girdle? Or all of the other times when I had someone suddenly attempting to rub my shoulders and ask me where my favorite port was to hang out with my favorite guy. I never thought that I could tell anyone about that, so I started asking my flying partners, what's your experience? And from 6 months to 30 years, they would talk about it, and they would say, yeah, we experienced this. And I said, what do you do when it happens? And I say, we tell them to stop, and I go, every time? And that's when the real conversation started. And they said, no, we have to de-escalate on the plane. We don't have time. We have too much to do. Also, who's going to care? And to a T, those conversations would end with, what I really had to realize was this was just part of the job. Now, that was really painful, hearing that as the flight attendant union president. And so we did collect stories, and we lifted this up because we wanted to use this moment to stamp it out. And let me just say that Peter DeFazio passed a bill that said that sexual harassment was going to be defined as one of the crimes on planes, and people were going to be fined and put in jail for even bigger penalties and bigger fees than ever before. But we weren't getting any stories from the men that I had worked with. And I gotta tell you, because we had been objectified, I saw plenty of men who were sexually harassed too, sometimes much worse than anything that I had ever experienced. And so I asked them, why are you not telling your stories? Why are you not? I know that you've experienced this. And they said to a T, they said, Sarah, because this is a moment for women's equality, and we are in a bargaining unit that 80% of our flying partners are women. And if we don't stand up for women's equality, then we're never going to have the kind of bargaining power that we need to make our careers better. That is the kind of understanding that we have as a working class and a labor movement, to understand that when someone is diminished or when someone is treated with disdain, that is our problem too. Because we are in jeopardy too. The old adage of the labor movement, an injury to one is an injury to all, is actually not really a call to help those in need. It is a call for building our power. So it's important for us to share these stories and take this in, especially in this moment. Back to the government shutdown. I didn't once say that guy's name who was in the White House. Not one time. Because when I looked at him and all the lies he was telling, that was the very definition of what my mom and Mrs. Eddy told me was error. And you don't give error your time. And I also know that even though they're going to do everything in their power to dismantle unions, they cannot dismantle our spirit and understanding
of our power together and our ability to build up community and our ability to feed each other by potluck. So this is a moment to understand that we have to start in the workplace because our democracy does not exist because it's a beautiful idea. Our democracy exists within the backdrop of capitalism. And if we don't have the ability to put capitalism in check with workers who rise up and demand our fair share of the value, all of the value that we create in this economy, then our politics will continue to go down a road of dictatorship, of people who will build a dick rocket to go up into space and leave the rest of us on a burning earth. So I come here tonight letting you know that I fought this dude before and I'm going to fight him again. Any questions?
I'm just wondering if you can talk a little bit about the any collaborative efforts that are going on among the various unions with the coming conservative government.
First of all, the labor movement got to a place of being totally enamored with being irrelevant. When you're irrelevant, nobody asks what the hell you're doing, because why does anybody care? And we got bought over by this idea that our mission was labor peace. That meant there was less collective bargaining. That meant there was less people participating in union democracy. That meant there was less people understanding and experiencing what it is to feel real power with the people around you. And it also meant, frankly, that in among the management ranks, there were fewer people who were involved in collective bargaining, because at the end of the day, even though you have that power struggle, the idea is to come to an agreement. And so as unions have declined, so have the ability for us to recognize that we can come to an agreement. It's become all about who can get 51% of the public to think we're right and have the best talking points, not to get any solutions. So I'll just say that the labor movement is not a group of 100 elected union presidents who are in Washington, D.C. It's not even all the people who have a union card in their pocket today. The labor movement is every single working person who wants to have respect for themselves, a good life, and expects that for their fellow workers too. And so there's absolutely talk about, I mean, you've heard it. There was a demand by UIW to line up union contracts for May 1st, 2028. I would just say to you that that idea of workers taking on the corporate class together with big demands 4 years from now is an idea that is very powerful for this moment. And when that takes hold in the public consciousness, that creates power before feet even hit the streets. So there are people who understand power and who are trying to come together to use it, but we have to do a hell of a lot more. The labor movement has always grown when young people have taken charge. And so the last thing I would just say is that women, people of color, young people, anyone who has been marginalized is more likely to be creative and understand how to make this work in this moment. And we need to call upon people who feel like all of our power is being taken away from us, who feel like everything that we have is at risk, to rise up and understand that when we are together and we lock arms, that we have power to make the bosses yield to our demands. And the last thing I would just say about that is that it can seem all lost until it's not. There is a tipping point. They will decide to fight us until they decide it is more expensive for them to fight us than to agree with us. And it can happen in the blink of an eye. The calls for one day longer, one day stronger is no small thing. The studios wanted to starve out the writers and said they were not going to do a deal. They wanted to wait until people were losing their homes. And they thought that was going to break the picket line, but it just made the strikers mad and more committed to the fight. And at the end of the day, the workers won through that solidarity. What I would finally say is don't look for the leadership to come. Look for ways that you can lead.
This is a two-part question. How should unions rethink our political strategy and endorsement of candidates that we stop supporting corporate Democrats who are committed to perpetual war? Is it time to build an independent labor party?
Let me just say, because workers struck, because workers started to strike before the pandemic and then continued that action through the pandemic, because Peter and I worked on a workers' first package that the airlines had to agree with, and it was the only industry not to grow in inequality because 80% of the workers are organized in the industry, and we were able to set those demands, the politics came to us. We had incredible bipartisan support because we flexed our muscles and set those demands and made them have to agree with us, even to cut their own pay and to ban stock buybacks. And the one thing that they fought to keep out of the bill, like fought tooth and nail, Delta Airlines fought tooth and nail, is the only thing they fought for, was to extract the sentence that said that no federal dollars could be spent on anti-union activity. They have money and control. We have the power. We exercise the power. We take control. We take the money. As far as the Workers' Party goes, we don't need another thing that splits us off into different groups. What we need is working class solidarity. I don't care if it's the Democrats, the Republicans, the Independents, or the purple people. If working people are expressing power, politics is going to reflect that. And so I would just say, I think it's a bit of a waste of time and effort to try to create something else, when what we really have to create is the unions that will express that power to bring the politics to us. So we have to understand that. Again, one of the four D's, delay. So that people get tired and get desperate, right? So we gotta recognize these things and act with urgency to fix them.
How do we build international solidarity, especially with workers in places like Palestine?
Working class people are not interested in war. Working class people are interested in taking care of our families and making a better life for our children. And once again, if we focus on working class people and understand that we're calling the question on which side are you on? Are you with the billionaires or are you with the people that you can identify with because they take pride in doing the same job that you do? That's the only way that we're going to change it. So we can do this when we make this real and personal to people, when people can identify with what the fight is about.
You were just listening to Sarah Nelson on Union Power. She spoke at the University of Oregon in Eugene in mid-November 2024. Sarah Nelson is the president of the Association of Flight Attendants Union, and a longtime advocate for workers' rights and unions. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Wendell Potter, Kuhan Pakmander, Ralph Nader, Peter Beinert, Chris Hedges, and Arundhati Roy. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Sarah Nelson on Union Power, and for Howard Zinn's classic book, A People's History of the United States, just call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Matt Laubach recorded the program. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. With Billy Bragg singing, There's Power in a Union.
In 2024, Trump was a wild card. He promised voters that he would be, in his words, their retribution. He named the enemy. He told voters what he was going to do to the enemy. He was the agent of revenge. The important emotion here is resentment. Resentment, of course, oozes from every pore of class society, and it isn't always appropriately directed. You know, workers often find it easier to hate middle-class professionals or cultural elites whom they do see than the billionaires whom they don't see.
That's Richard Seymour, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Richard Seymour on resentment politics. There's a class in this country that reeks of obscene wealth. From mansions in Beverly Hills and the Hamptons, they fly around in their private jets and sail the seas in their luxury yachts. Left behind are countless millions who are subjected to austerity programs and lectures about hard work. The rise, not just in the United States, but globally, of right-wing politics is fueled by economic inequality. Joseph Goebbels was Hitler's minister of propaganda. He always insisted that it was a mistake to rely on logic and facts to manipulate people. The skilled propagandist, he said, must focus on emotions, not reason. Everything must be depicted in simple terms and constantly repeated. Resentment is a powerful force. We see it in today's politics. Our guest today is Richard Seymour. He's a writer, broadcaster, and author of numerous books, including Disaster Nationalism. His articles appear in the New York Times, London Review of Books, The Guardian, and Jacobin. He spoke at the Socialism 2025 conference in Chicago in July. And now, Richard Seymour on resentment politics.
So I want to start with Trump. Trump's expanded his electoral base in every election since 2016. In 2024, he gained among working class voters, or rather those who actually bothered to turn out. In each election, he also gained among non-white voters. And it's worth noting, his share of the white vote remains roughly below that achieved by Mitt Romney in 2012. Now, there's nothing shocking in Trump's ascendancy. It's been the pattern in India, the Philippines, Hungary, Brazil. It's the pattern in France, where Le Pen's share of the presidential vote climbs in each outing. It's the pattern in Germany, where the AfD is now the second largest party. And now in the UK, where Reform could possibly win the next general election. Certainly, when